everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 13th, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I want to give a shout out, as always, to my top patrons this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because I rely on the support of my listeners, people just like you. In order to keep it free for everyone, a handful of people really, really graciously do give their financial support. And if you're interested in doing that so that you can offset that cost for those who can't afford to give, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. So big shout out to my top tier this week. These are the coolest people in the universe: Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Mary Neva, and also the coolest people in the galaxy: Brian Holden, David Compton, Dudas Infinitas, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, Joe Wilkinson, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, and Ulrika Hagman. Thank you all so much. All right, we have a great one today. Ooh, it's good. It's so good. Okay, I had the opportunity to sit down with, remotely, of course, as always, Dr. Kara Cooney. She is a professor of Egyptian art and architecture at UCLA. So we're going to talk about Egypt. We're going to talk about ancient Egypt. We're going to talk about her new book, The Good Kings, Absolute Power in Ancient Egypt and the Modern World. And we're going to talk in great detail about the role of men, the role of women, the role of gender, and what this society looked like, you know, from so long ago, and how we can really learn about our own society when we dig deep. So yeah, let's do this, you guys. Without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Kara Cooney. Well, Kara, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
It's funny to have a Kara on Kara's podcast, because I will say it's not, you know, it's not the rarest name in the world, but I very rarely communicate with other Karas.
No, it's an odd name, and you're with a C and I'm with a K, so we're still different. But have you ever tried to take your name to Italy? They can't handle it there.
Oh no, they can't. For me, Spanish and Italian blows their minds, because it actually is a Spanish and Italian word with the C.
Yes.
Yeah, like Kara,
sweetie. They're like, hey, sweetie, and they can't do it.
They can't do it. Yeah. Because Kara in Spanish, it's funny, people love to tell me, and I'm like, no, I know. Means either expensive, or face. Like, your face is su cara.
Right.
But of course, in Italian, cara mia, it's like my dear, my beloved, my sweetie. Yeah.
Yeah, and it upsets colleagues so much. I'm like, just call me Chiara, and they're like, okay, I can do that. And
Chiara. Yeah, that's true, because that's a very common Italian name.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's funny. That's a good hack. I might have to borrow that. So, you know, we met several years ago, actually, when there was a panel at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. They were doing an exhibit, and it was like half Egyptian and half Peruvian.
That's right.
And we did sort of the Egyptian side of it while we did this kind of fun thing where we watched, like, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark or something like that. And we were like, what's real and what's not?
And there were a lot of mummies involved and ghosts and spirits and what do we believe or not. And I remember the lights went out, right, during that panel. So everything happened. It was great. I remember that being a really fun night. So
that was really fun. It was really fun. And for me, I learned an awful lot. And so I'm excited to kind of brush up and learn even more today, because you are, would you call yourself, I mean, is the word an Egyptologist? Is that the phrase that people use, or the term?
It's a term, it's a word, and I do claim it, but it's interesting that it's becoming more loaded and weighty by the day as Egyptologists really come to grips with their colonialist discipline and the way objects have been taken from the country and all of these things that we have to reckon with. Calling yourself an Egyptologist it carries all that weight with it. So while I might rename myself, that kind of is a cop-out in a sense. I mean, this is what I am, and I have to own it. And if I'm going to change the discipline, I have to try to do it from the inside. Names matter. And all of us are looking at our monikers and going, what does that mean? What is that? What is that about? And the name of my profession is no different.
Absolutely. And I mean, in your bio, you're listed, or at least by National Geographic, who published your newest book, you're listed as a professor of Egyptian art and architecture at UCLA. And so did you study anthropology? Did you study art history? Like, what was your sort of path to get to that place?
Yeah, it's a weird thing the way we categorize and separate up disciplines into mm-hmm. you're the language person, you're the art person. And while technically I'm the art person at UCLA, I do teach language as well and history, and I'm a holistic scholar. So I bring all of these things into play. But you know, when you're getting a new line filled at a college or university, they're like, oh, well, we have to fill this specialization or that specialization. And it's just often the way it works. So it's a weird title that I don't necessarily jive with, but right. I am an art historian, and I was trained at Johns Hopkins University as a scholar of religion, language, art, history, all of those things. And when you're studying the ancient world in particular, you don't go to a history department or an anthropology department and study it from a theoretical perspective. Instead, you go to an area studies department, which means you're going to a department that works in a particular part of the globe. Mm. And I'm chair of such a department at UCLA now. I'm chair of the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department. Near Eastern, it's another colonial name that means nearer east as opposed to far east. Middle East is another word for this. And I was trained in a Near Eastern Studies department at Johns Hopkins, and they did everything West Asian and North African, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Levantine studies, Persian studies, things like that. And so you end up focusing on the geographic place first, and then you kind of later decide, okay, well, I'm an art historian, or I'm a historian, or, you know, you bring those more theoretical divisions later. So it gets, you know, it's complicated stuff, this academic world that we're a part of, but really we're all just trying to figure out what the hell happened in the past right. and why it matters. Yeah.
Right. And of course, you know, we are in the West. We live in the West. We were born and raised, you and I, I'm making an assumption here, but at least for myself, born and raised here in the United States, and curious about parts of the world that we don't come from. So when you talk about sort of the academic world and the past that we're trying to reckon with, I'm curious how much of your work is in collaboration with colleagues who do come from the parts of the world that you study, colleagues who have their boots on the ground and who, you know, grew up in these regions and are curious because it's their own personal history.
Yeah, that's becoming more and more the norm. As I said, I'm part of a colonial discipline that has systematically excluded Egyptians from the study of their own past. And that it is amazing. So you get occupations by Ottoman Turks, Ottoman Armenian Turks, it's complicated. And then the French come in, and then the British come in. And this exclusion, it means that the French and the British were running the antiquity show, and being an Egyptologist as an Egyptian was nearly impossible until the revolution of the 1950s. And so now, obviously, with Egypt owning its past and really connecting with it, so many of my colleagues are Egyptian born and bred, and they have a very different perspective about this ancient past. And you might think, oh, well, you live in Egypt, you're you know, connected to the language and the culture and the religion, but they're not either, because Egyptian colonialism, one could argue, goes very deep. You could argue that the insertion of Roman Christianity is a colonialism that drove a wedge between Egyptian people and their ancient religion. And then the Arab colonialism of the 7th and 8th centuries drove a wedge between Egyptian people and their own language, such that Coptic, or Egyptian language as we understand it, was abandoned in favor of Arabic, because that was the way to get ahead. That was the way to connect with the elites who were running their country. And so, you know, talking with modern Egyptians, you get just as much complication of whose past is this? How does it work? Why are we studying this? What is it for? What do these temples mean? What do these mummies mean? And so all of these things are conundrums and mysteries that we're figuring out within our own cultural upbringings and psyches. It's super interesting, though. It's great.
And it's fascinating. And to add even another layer to the complication, but also the richness, of course, your new book is called The Good Kings, and we'll get to that soon. But you previously wrote When Women Ruled the World and The Woman Who Would Be King, and you focus in large part, I mean, not totally, but in large part, your studies do focus on gender studies and on how gender played into the cultural milieu. And that's obviously another deep, deep wrinkle because, as we know, so often history is not just written by, or at least the history that we often read was written by Westerners. It was written by men, like
Written by men for men within patriarchal structures. And I'm still doing my academic work and we're doing this podcast within patriarchal structures that are trying to control women in every way that they possibly can. My women's studies through the lens of Egypt gives me an extraordinary opportunity because Egypt is this bright and shiny thing that everyone wants to know about, whether you're from Peru or Japan or the United States or Egypt. It's like, who are these people? Look at their monumental structures. Look at that coffin of solid gold. Oh my God, oh my God. And everyone is drawn to it. And I am starting at a higher level with my audience because people are obsessed with Egypt's power, its materiality, its ability to communicate through hieroglyphs and extraordinary symbolism. And so I can use that love of this ancient culture and say, okay, now why do we not allow women to rule? Why did the Egyptians allow women systematic rule? What was that power like? And how can we understand it? And so I use the Egyptians as kind of the shiny golden thing that attracts the audience. And then I bring in discussions that we need to be having in modern society as well.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, this specific book is about that absolute power and really focuses on that. And I'm curious, you know, for those of us who maybe have ideas in our heads but haven't done any real deep dives and are sort of just passively exposed to this information, maybe we've walked through a couple of museums, maybe we've seen a couple in passing some things on television, some documentary series. Can you help us understand what the gender kind of norm was within the power structure in ancient Egypt?
Ancient Egypt was patriarchal like any other quote unquote civilization. Mm-hmm. Civilization runs power through men because men can create a legacy through having children outside of their own bodies. It's a very biological reasoning that they don't have to give birth and lactate and care in the same way that women do through their bodies. And so just biologically, we have given power of resources over men, and then we have made women into baby making machines to create more power for men. That's right. As simplistically as I can put it. Now, having said that Egypt is patriarchal too, why did Egypt allow women to have such power systematically? And that's a conundrum that I've really tried to solve in my first two books, and in particularly in When Women Ruled the World. You know, what is this about? How does a patriarchal society let women rule as nothing less than leader of state, as king, and then make the kingship office malleable, something that can work for a woman, that can be feminized? And how am I to understand it? Why is, even in this system that allows such female power, why is there then still a backlash discernible in the historical texts? I can see the backlash against strong female power in the mid-18th dynasty, for example, after the rule of the great female king Hatshepsut. And so I'm working through all of these conundrums and trying to understand how that female power worked. And in short, I'll tell you that when Egyptian power was run through an authoritarian dynasty, power held in the hands of very few, very unequal authoritarian system, but run through a family. That's what a dynasty is, right? Mm-hmm. Then when there's some sort of issue in that dynasty, the Egyptians decided, and it's not just one Egyptian, no one person can claim power. It's groups of elites who are deciding this together. They decide that to keep the status quo, allowing a woman to rule is the best solution. Avoids bloodshed, warlording, overt competition, and it allows their dynasties to be longer lived than in other parts of the world. I mean, it's super complicated. You know, Egypt is geographically blessed with very strong boundaries, and it's geographically blessed with a very hardy Nile that can create agricultural surplus in abundance. So Egypt doesn't have a lot of invasion from outside. It doesn't have a lot of competition for scarce resources inside because everyone's a little bit drunk on lots of carbs and a whole lot of beer.
And they don't really need to leave to invade other regions for resources.
No, they have all their resources. All they lack is tin maybe and some resins from trees. I mean, really, they don't lack much. They have almost everything they need within their Nile Valley and their desert borders and some closely adjacent lands. So the status quo is damn good for them. And so you have this cultural agreement of, oh crap, the king just died and his son is only 12. Well, I know what to do. We'll let his mother rule and make the decisions. She'll be regent. And then when he's old enough, you know, she'll step back in the shadows and we'll have a king who's all grown up and ready to make decisions on his own. It'll be fine. The Egyptians did that dozens of times. And some five times, those women rose to leader of state themselves. And it's an extraordinary thing to see how an attempt to keep power ends up giving women power in Egypt so regularly.
Yeah. And I think it's so telling that even kind of the turn of phrase that you use, like allowing women, giving women, because still we have this fantasy in our minds that the world used to be matriarchal and that this kind of patriarchal, misogynistic, male dominant thing is somewhat new, but it's not, right? Even in cultures where women did have power, it wasn't the equal and opposite to how things are now.
No, I'm of two minds of this. I mean, first, let's burst that matriarchal bubble. It's BS. It doesn't exist.
Right.
It even in hunter-gatherer communities, there is no matriarchal hunter-gatherer community. If a matriarchy is women having the power over men, it doesn't exist. We're so used to patriarchy that when we see women having near equal power, we're like, it was a matriarchy.
Right.
And it wasn't. It wasn't anything of the sort. So, you know, patriarchies are what we know. It is the water in which we swim. It is so hard for us to see our own misogyny, systematic or systemic misogyny, and our own knee-jerk reactions to female power. But they're there. I will push back a little bit and say, you know, if a lot of hunter-gatherer communities could have equal power between males and females, or near equal power between males and females, there was more of an egalitarian leadership, even with women bearing children and breastfeeding and responsible for a lot of the caretaking in the vast variety of hunter-gatherer communities. Civilization on this planet, and I use civilization in scare quotes because it's not always very civilized, is very new in most parts of the world. And where I sit in Southern California, where the Tongva people, until a couple hundred years ago, really had sovereignty over their land and lived in sustainability with their land, they had near equal male-female gender distribution of power. And that's a couple hundred years ago that was wiped away by a patriarchal invasion of colonial forces. If we go to the oldest parts of the world where civilization became a thing, and we can go to Mesopotamia, we can go to Egypt, we're talking about, you know, 4,000 BCE, 5,000 BCE, you know, first agriculture, things like that. It's not that old. So this water in which we swim is like 7,000, 8,000, maybe 10,000 years old at best. And humans, as soon as they can, as soon as the patriarchy doesn't become as useful a thing, people quickly, very quickly are like, oh, I don't have to be binary sexually. Okay, fine. I'm going to be this other thing. Or, Oh, you're not going to impose patriarchal marriage upon me? Okay, then I'm just not going to do it. Oh, you're not going to impose regularized childbirth on me? Okay, so I've decided I don't want kids. And people like to have their sexual freedoms too. And as soon as they can, as soon as economies of patriarchy loosen, as we move into what I think is really another human revolution, a big human revolution. If we've had an agriculture revolution, an industrial revolution, a sexual revolution, because you and I are talking to each other, then we're going through a post-patriarchal revolution, and it's going to take a long time. And we need a view to the past and how we've treated women, how we understand power, to understand where we're going. And there's a line in my book that speaks to this, that we, and I always get it wrong, so let me see if I can get it right this time, that we need to forget what we think we know, and we need to remember what we have forgotten. We as a big humanity with a large organism all together as a communal us, right? And we need to have a longer perspective of what we are. We are not just 200 years ago. We are not 5,000 years ago. We are 200,000 years ago. We are a species that has been on this planet living in sustainability for most of our time on this planet. That is what we must return to, or we're not going to make it through.
Absolutely. And the truth of the matter is we come from that. Like you mentioned, this patriarchal kind of normativity only starting 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, or even, you know, sooner than that. But 200,000 years ago was when Homo sapiens sort of arbitrarily became Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. And if we are alive today, it's because we come from a direct genetic line. It's because our ancestors figured it out and they managed to survive and make more of us. And so something going back 10,000, 50,000, 100, 200,000 years ago worked. It was cooperative and we persisted.
Yeah. And so we need to look to how the patriarchy, and it's fighting hard and effectively, how it uses ideology of patriotism, nationalism, fear of the foreigner coming to take your stuff, of the woman losing control of her sexuality, of all kinds of things, you know, how it controls us through religious ideology of not getting salvation in the next life. All of these things are up for debate and discussion right now. And you can throw the gun debate in there too. There's a reason that this country of minority rule also imposes minority gun ownership and regularized massacres. And that is, in my opinion, the beginnings of this post-patriarchal revolution that we are going through, because those massacres are committed by men, sometimes very young, sometimes older, but who are losing their power, and they are committing it against women and children. By and large, most massacres start with the murder of a woman or the shooting of a woman.
Yeah, whether and then it's grandma, goes on, mother, wife,
exactly, and then you go from there. And you, but that's so. When people say, "Oh, what is the Civil War going to be like?" I'm like, "We're in it. It's happening. It's already begun. You don't need shots when people are reorganizing themselves into different states with different laws, and these daily gun massacres make it all very clear to me that female power, or even non-binary imposed power, is being discussed whether we want it to be or not.
And it's scaring the shit out of the men who...
It is.
It's true. I mean, I have a friend who is kind of more steeped in kind of modern race and ethnic studies. And I remember having a discussion with her around the Black Lives Matter movement, and then now moving into these horrific shootings that are often perpetrated by, you know, people who have been on, I should say men, boys, who have been, you know, on incel websites and who have put out anti-woman and people of color manifestos, white supremacist manifestos. And there is this view of kind of like passively a white dude could sort of be average and still have everything he needed. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden he feels like, oh shit, I have to work for what I need just like any other person on the planet.
Yeah, and work for love and work for care and all of these
different things. It's not just going to be given to me by virtue of my birthright. And that's a really hard thing for them to come to grips with.
And, you know, in my book, The Good Kings, you know, we're talking about gun violence and people would be like, get back to Egypt. What the hell are you even talking about? But in The Good Kings, I talk about the Egyptians creating the weapons of the mind. They're not known as being violent, right? I mean, yeah, there's smiting motifs on every temple, but we don't think of ancient Egypt as a violent place like we might ancient Assyria or Aztec sacrifices or stuff like that. Though there are sacrifices in First Dynasty Egypt too. But it's interesting how patriarchy is so attracted to pyramids, that that is their divinity of power, because the pyramid is probably the most effective weapon of the mind I have ever experienced that still works upon a modern human population obsessed with watching Ancient Aliens on the History Channel and thinking, you know, this patriarchy has a connection to some secret power source and this pyramid proves it. And there, you know, Egypt excelled at exhibiting patriarchal power through a fatherly embrace that makes you feel safe and everything's going to be okay. And, you know, you're worried about the sun rising and setting. Don't worry. The chief priest king he's got it all figured out and you just need to give him like all your taxes and it's all going to be fine.
Right. And I mean, to be fair, like it's interesting because I work at my other podcast that I work on and my other sort of energy is put into skeptic activism and really like looking at the world through a scientific skeptical lens. Yet I don't really think I fully understand the lore around the pyramid and how it's been, I shouldn't say co-opted, because as you mentioned, like it was sort of it was used even in its present day. But like what does it represent? Like what exactly is this sort of fascination? Because I'm not sure I fully understand it.
Yeah, no, I wrote the whole first chapter about Khufu trying to understand this myself. And I came up with some insights that I didn't know I had in me, which were kind of fun, that that a pyramid, you don't build it because you can. You build it arguably because you have to. Because by the time they build the pyramid, it's fourth dynasty. Kingship is getting a little stale. They have to reinvent themselves like Lady Gaga or Madonna. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got to become something new. And kingship has this, you know, memory attached to the human sacrifices of the first dynasty, some of the excesses of the second and third dynasties, arguably. And so kingship is like, no, we're going to create a miracle in stone. And it takes Khufu's father, Snefru, three tries to get a straight-sided pyramid of stone built. They try to make it much higher, probably to mimic what they think are the solar rays coming down to Earth, because a straight-sided pyramid is meant to evoke sunlight in stone. It's like, these are the sun's rays. They try to make it a 65-degree angle and everything goes horribly wrong. There's cracks in the foundation and the stones. It's awful. There's one pyramid called the Bent Pyramid that Snefru built, where he starts out at a 60-some-degree angle and the top is all, you know, he changes it to a 45-degree angle and it looks kind of weird. Yeah. And so then the next pyramid he builds, the whole thing is like 45 to 47 degrees. That's the Red Pyramid. And that's probably the one he's buried in. That's your first true straight-sided pyramid. And Khufu takes that and he runs with it. And he not only builds a pyramid, but he builds a pyramid within which float, in a way, within the limestone mass of the structure, hard granite chambers, a grand gallery, things that should be crushed by the weight of the limestone above it and around it, but are not, because they create these relieving chambers. And the engineering is insane. Mm. And we still don't know how he did it. That's the other thing that create shock and awe in our minds. You know, ask an Egyptologist how the pyramids were built. Go ask three. You want to start a bar fight, go to an old kingdom conference and ask three Egyptologists, how are the pyramids built? And you're off to the races. They'll be like, well, they use ramps. Well, they use levers. Well, no, they put the outside walls on first and they did like an inside out pyramid so that you didn't fall off the side. And people are like, no, there were hydraulics involved. And there must've been, but until how high? And how are we to understand, if we don't even know that, how the pyramids were built? And the Egyptians, it means, given our lack of knowledge, that this was a weapon. It was a weapon that, you know, we don't put blueprints out about how to build a hydrogen bomb.
Right.
Though the minority may have blueprints out about how to build a plastic gun. That's that's debatable about why that's out there in the interwebs. But these weapons...
Right, that's a militia, right? That's not a power structure.
Yeah, maybe. But you know, to build these structures, you want to keep it exclusive. You want to keep it close to the vest. And the coolest thing about Khufu is once they built it, by building that miracle in stone, he empowered his elites and had to pay them so well and had to keep... He ended up creating a monster that he couldn't control. And that was the last great pyramid ever built like that. Khafre's pyramid is not, it doesn't come anywhere close in comparison to Khufu's. And so he created the most perfect mythical kingship and now just stands there and looks at us and haunts us. And we continue to use it. And I guarantee you the Egyptians use those pyramids as well to manufacture that ideological power for their, for the office of kingship.
So there's this kind of, I can't remember how you referred to it, but this like almost mental weapon. Mm-hmm. But also, what was its, from a utilitarian perspective, like obviously we think of them as tombs because we are very often looking in hindsight from our historical perspective. But what were they used for in contemporary times? Were they the actual, quote, castles?
No, they had no practical use. No practical use except beyond. And there have been arguments that there's a Keynesian economic mechanism built in that we may not articulate, but is there, that you're giving a mass of Egyptians a little stimulus check, if you like, when the Nile is flooded and people don't have anything else to do. You call them up for draft service and you're like, here's all your bread and beer, and people are find camaraderie in those drafted communities. And then they go home all fat and happy with the king's stored grain in their bellies. And that's, you know, that's one way of understanding it. I think it's a little positivist in my opinion. But there is a practical redistribution element there. And there, you know, it creates technology too. So, you know, by being able to build pyramids like that, the Egyptians became very skilled at stone architecture and movement of stones. How practical is that? Did they use it in warfare? Not really. Did they, you know, even their structures of defense are going to be built of mud brick, not of stone. So the practicality is as a political reminder, in my opinion, so that people living in Memphis look up from their daily labor and see the pyramids on the landscape and know by whom they are ruled and know to whom their labors go. And that reminder is essential. And we have those things in our society as well. You drive around, you see all the American flags. And now, as we enter our post-patriarchal movement, you know that the house with an American flag on it is usually more conservative.
Yeah, it represents more something really, really different than it did in the 40s, I guess.
It certainly does. It's more pyramidal in its understanding of society. That's what that flag means. So these ciphers are all around us. And it's hard to, when you know, people look at a flag and they're like, why am I filled with such emotions? What does it mean? Why does that make me angry to see an American flag? Maybe you're not angry when you see it at the post office because you're like, well, they have to have it. Okay, fine. But then when you see it in front of someone's house, you're like, what are you doing? What does that mean? When I see a California flag in walking around my neighborhood, I have a completely different feeling than I do when I see an American flag. And it's just so, you know, we take away people's Confederate flags, fine, they're just going to fly, you know, a blue line American flag or whatever. But it's, you know, we have the,
Exactly.
We have these same things all around us, and those are very powerful symbols. And then people say, oh, it's my heritage, you know, it's my history. Don't take it. You can't. And in a way, we can't take it. It's there embedded in all of our systems. These are powerful things in society.
Absolutely. And I'm curious, you know, you've obviously spent your entire career digging deep into trying to understand the ciphers that were left behind, right? Because we have to piece together our understanding of history based on, the things that we can see, the things that we can measure, the things that were left behind, the breadcrumbs. And of course, as we mentioned, those breadcrumbs were often left behind by those in the dominant position of power. And so I'm curious, like, as you've been doing your work, and especially from this, I think, important feminist perspective, What are some things that you've sort of learned that have surprised you? Or maybe even they didn't surprise you, but you wish more people understood about the power structure in ancient Egypt, about how kings ruled, about maybe some of the parallels between something from thousands of years ago and today?
Yeah, I mean, first I'll say that the ciphers work on multiple levels simultaneously, always have, always do, still do, such that an elite and educated community of people will have a different understanding of the ciphers than the everyday populist rabble, if I may. Mm-hmm, so, yeah. So just to take the example of Hatshepsut's statuary, this great female king who ruled altogether for about 22 years, she in most of her statuary is depicted as a man. She's shown with a strong jaw, with broad shoulders, with all of the musculature that goes with being a man. And yet the text on that statue, for those few people, 5% or less, who were literate, they would see she and her as the pronouns used. And they would understand, we are talking about a woman. So some people got access to some ciphers and some people got access to others, in the same way that we might show certain symbolism or say certain things in exclusive country club gatherings among the rich, but we wouldn't say those things at a big speech for everybody at a rally, right? So right.
There's
always
dog whistles.
Exactly. Yeah.
So and even a Disney movie, like you're going to mm-hmm. watch it with your kids, you're going to get something different than your kids are going to get out of it because there's, of your context. Yes.
Every Disney movie has two audiences, one for the adults, right. One for the kid. And you know, as a child, you grow up and you're like, oh my God, that was there the whole time. They're talking about sex and I didn't get that. Now I get that. Yeah. It's always funny. But the things that surprise me are always there. And, you know, The Good Kings is about blowing up our modern exceptionalism and stopping this idea that the ancient Egyptians were this mysterious people that we can fetishize. They're just us. They're just like us. And showing Egypt and putting the king forward and saying, look at his weird hats. Look, he holds a crook and a flail. Look, he's got a coffin of solid gold. Seems weird and strange, right? Well, now you can see the authoritarianism. Uh-huh. You can see it. You can see the ciphers. Okay, now that you can see it, look at your own world. Because the Egyptians, you know, that was the water in which they swam. And they had a hard time differentiating the religion from politics too. Now look at your world and see, oh yeah, in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s post-World War, wearing the military kit was like a way of showing patriotism and nationalism and good values. Then it became problematic because it was the uniform of the despot. And so everyone abandoned it. And they're like, oh no, we can't wear a military kit anymore. That makes me look like a dictator. Now they all wear suits and ties, right? So they're the good businessman because capitalism is good and pure and it's going to save us all, blah, blah, blah. And then as we move in a new direction, people are losing the tie, right? So you see like Duterte never wears a tie. The Iranian president never wears a tie.
Yeah, because they're populist. They're one of you. Yeah, except they're not at all. It's just a costume.
And it's a costume, but we think, no, it's just a shirt. What are you're making all this up? But it's not. It is the cipher that is so effective upon us because it is part of our quotidian everyday fabric. And we are embedded in that. And the weirdness of Egypt wakes us up and makes us go, oh, I see it. I see it. And then I'm like, okay, now look in your world. Can you see it too? Oh yeah, a little bit. I can kind of see it. And so that is it never fails to excite me and it never fails to unnerve some of my colleagues who like to say that the ancient world should be studied on its own terms, that we cannot be universalist, that we must put these things in their own particular categories and that the politics should not be brought into these things. And then I retort, all the time.
It's all politics. Like you can't separate the context of the time from the people living in the context, and you can't separate the present from the past because we came from that.
But this is what we're saying now. This is not what I grew up with in my PhD training, and it's certainly not the way we were taught to do history, that history should be done for its own sake, not, if you're an Americanist, okay, fine. You're doing history to understand the America that we live in. But if you're an Egyptologist, you're just trying to figure out the ancient people, because why not? Because they were there and they're mysterious and we want to know, instead of learning about Egypt to understand about us.
That's, right. And also that's unusual. It's the same people. Like we're yeah. all the same people. If you yeah. took us at birth and put us anywhere in any time, in any culture, we're going to come up based on the context of our culture. And that's going to be normative to us. But like our genetics, our basic fundamental peopleness, humanity didn't change 2000 years ago to now. We're the exact same. There might be a yes. couple weird bones. Like I know that yeah, there's like a yeah. few things we can point to that say, okay, we were slightly smaller in stature, but yeah. really we're the same.
Yeah. Like when I try to sit in a movie theater seat from the 20s in downtown right, Hollywood, I'm yeah. like, holy gods, how tiny were these people? And I'm 6'2" right, and not small. Right. And so, yes, it's totally true. But you know, just watching like the History Channel or National Geographic or whatever you mm-hmm. about Egypt, they make them different. They're like, These mysterious beings came up with these strange and unusual ways, and we make them separate. And that works very well for patriarchal systems. And that's why we also celebrate these Egyptians and make them special. It works for us to present them as these wonderful good kings. It helps us to celebrate our own patriarch. So, you know, yeah. it's all part of the same game.
And, you know, I'm super curious and kind of getting into specifics. Like I'm looking at even just the cover of your book, The Good Kings, and I think it's Nefertiti on the cover, right?
No, it's funny because it's a very feminized face, but that is the coffin in which Ramses II was reburied.
Oh, that's Ramses.
And it's not Ramses, because that's a reused coffin.
Cool.
And I know, right? And it's a very complicated story, and I'm writing that book now. It's all about coffin reuse, and it's called Recycling for Death, and it'll come out with American University in Cairo Press in 2022 at the end, beginning awesome. Of 2023. We'll see, but that's a smiling, sweet king. You know, it's so interesting that you say it looks like a woman, because the Egyptian kings, again, excelled at showing their kindness, their yeah. smile.
I
right?
was going to ask, like, yeah. there's almost an androgyny to mm-hmm. a lot of the like, there's the eyeliner and the, yeah. and the feministic features. And yeah. of course, with the queens, there's a, as you mentioned before, there's, and I don't know if this, do they put like I don't know what you would even call that. The thing on their chin that looks like a beard.
Oh yeah, the false beard.
Yeah. Do you see that on queens as well, or only on men?
It depends on the female king. I like to say female king for those women who reached highest
Good. I like that.
Level
yeah.
of state, because the Egyptians called them king. So, you know,
That's
the word
awesome.
Queen was just the sexual helpmate of the king. So
right.
if they called them king, I'll call them king. For those kings that were longer lived, like Hatshepsut, and really there's only one, Hatshepsut wore the false beard.
Okay.
Most female kings did not. So
There's still some kind of division, but of course there is that dancing with androgyny and non-binary status.
Absolutely. The Egyptians, oh my God, the Egyptians got all into non-binary creation. And I wrote a series of articles on the gender change that a coffin can allow for a female so that she can be reborn as Osiris, because and I'm going to get a little technical and a little sexual, so hold on. But the creation of the Egyptian world was thought to be the god becoming aware of himself and to create himself within a mass of chaotic matter, darkness, and infinity, reaching out to his penis, masturbating himself into a big bang of self-creation, and
wow.
then ejaculating and spitting out the next generation of divinities, who then had normal sex with each other to create the next generation, and so on.
Wait, but these kings thought that they were godges?
Kind of, yes.
My
kind
God.
Of. So, but think of it in one body, and the Egyptians went to town with this. The god who created was male, but he created with his hand, his gerret. And the T, just like Smurf and Smurfette,
yeah.
the T is the feminine ending. So using
his it's just like Adam and his stupid rib becoming
eaten. It is Adam and his stupid rib. So he takes his hand, his feminine container, and he creates himself with that feminine part of himself. But, you know, unlike the rib, which is removed from Adam and then not put back, the God always carries those hands around with him. And it's interesting. Every coffin of a male always has a fisted hand, because he is meant arguably to bring himself back to life in that manner.
That's so funny.
It's crazy. And females, when they're buried, the Egyptians had this anxiety. They're like, oh my God, this woman, you know, we want, she's great ancestor. We want her to be a great ancestor, to be reborn. She has to become like Osiris. So they actually named women. Like if I were going to die and be an elite and get a coffin in the new kingdom, I would be called Osiris Professor Kara. And I would be associated with Osiris, not with Hathor, not with Isis, but with that god of self-regeneration. And so there's all kinds of gender fluidity within Egyptian religion that is really interesting.
What about core companionship, the family structure? How common, and I don't even know if we have enough evidence to point to this, but how common was... like were gay relationships, were kind of different gendered relationships, or was it pretty heteronormative?
This is so interesting, and it's something that scholars are starting to work on more and more. So I'll start with the heteronormative question first. Mm-hmm. The homosexuality between men, and there's very little discussion about homosexuality between women, in a binary reality, right?
I'm like, it was probably so common.
Of course it was common, but patriarchal binary roles are imposed on everyone. Right. Whether you're a farmer or a king, it is imposed on you. You know, a Roman emperor can get away with a whole lot of shit, but a Roman emperor is still going to have a wife and offspring, right? Ideally. So
In the light, and then in the dark, whatever goes.
Exactly. So, you know, the richer and more powerful you are, the more able you are to maybe live that life out in the light of day. Having said that, there is very little positive reaction to that within Egyptian literature. And I'll give you one example. And there's a wonderful tale of Horus and Seth, which is super bawdy and really fun. So everyone should look that up, get on your computers and put Egyptian tale, Horus and Seth. You'll find a translation and it's awesome. And
there's you're going to give us the Cliffs Notes, right?
Yes, of course. I'll find one online and you can post it in your show notes. But there's a section where Seth is planning to rape Horus and show that he is powerful over this boy. And so he's going to perform the sex act. He's not embarrassed of saying it. He's not embarrassed that he's going to do it. He's able to do it. Horus is canny and knows he's going to do it. And so he puts his hand there so that Seth is fooled and thinks that the hand is the anus. And then he catches the semen. He shows it to his mother, Horus does, who gives out a great shout, chops off his hand. I'm not kidding. He takes the hand with the semen in it of Seth and then grows Horus a new hand. It's a complicated tale. But the point is going back to your question about heteronormative realities, it was okay for Seth to say, I'm going to rape my nephew.
Right.
But he's doing so in a prison sex power move kind of way. This is
like
not happy joy
joy. Runner situation.
This is
about power.
Yes. Yes. This is not a sustainable, happy relationship. This is not, you know, I get to be out. This is a different kind of thing. And one doesn't really see that kind of sexual freedom in terms of male-male homosexuality. And then female-female homosexuality really isn't even mentioned. Having said that, I will say that in Egyptian society, in normal Egyptian society, like in the craftsman's village of Deir el-Medina, you see evidence that women could initiate a divorce. That women didn't have virginity tests when they got married. And hell, even marriage isn't really a thing in ancient Egypt. You don't really see a ceremony. It's an economic arrangement. And there's no like premarital sex freakouts. And there's a lot more rituals associated with sexual licentiousness. The Feast of Drunkenness to Hathor or Mut, you know, these festivals where people just really let go. And I guarantee you there were some homosexual activities there, but why would that be? You know, you'd be like, okay, we're in a patriarchal society. Why would the Egyptians allow females all of this power when if you go to Greece or Rome or over to West Asia of the Bible or Mesopotamia, you know, if a woman's caught in an adulterous relationship, you must stone her or kill her or do something horrible. I would argue that, and this is the dirty underbelly of a lot of Egypt's social allowance. And it's that Egypt is so authoritarian and so socially unequal that most Egyptians didn't own property. And most Egyptians were sharecropping, were farming someone else's land. And as such, most Egyptians didn't have to compete for resources, for ownership, didn't have to work to make sure their lineage was pure. If you had a kid with that guy and with that guy, it wasn't a deal breaker because, you know, we're all just kind of sharecropping. In the same way that in any society that has unequal capitalist divisions, you can see the poor of that society have a much freer sexual understanding, less marriage, less family cohesion. It's not because they're less moral, though that's what conservatives would love to tell you. It's because economically they don't need it. They can be humans as humans are, and they don't have the strictures imposed by economic private property ownership and the handing down of that property to the next generation. So it's kind of good. It's kind of bad at the same time, right? So what you pick your poison, I don't know.
You even see this in a lot of different primate species where, you know, these individuals are sort of cooperatively raising children and you have these different kind of partnerships or dalliances based on sort of the mood of the day and a lot of like women working together to raise all the children together and kind of just having sex whenever, you know, the mood strikes them. And it's fascinating to think about the fact that these patriarchal, but also beyond patriarchy, these dictatorial, I guess you could say, or authoritarian regimes persisted throughout ancient Egypt, that there was always this huge division between rich and poor. And did we ever see any examples of uprisings? Did we ever see a push for any sort of democratic process? Or like how for so long were they able to maintain these power structures?
I mean, yeah, that's why I wrote the book. I'm like, how do you keep this? Yeah. How do you hold this wolf by the ears for 3,000 years and make it work? And continue it and even go through intermediate periods that we call them intermediate periods when centralized kingship fails. And even then you see elite warlords taking up the mantle. There may be like five or six of them at a time, but they still seem to maintain their patriarchal power. It's hard to revolt when the means of your revolution will be that you starve. If most of the labor and most of the poor people are peasants, who are taking a portion of their grain and giving it to the elite, to the wealthy, if they go on strike and say, I'm not working for you anymore, they will starve. Their families will starve. It is very hard for sharecroppers to revolt in that way. And you don't see actual revolts. Instead, when things get really hard, people, they walk away. They, you know, if there's a drought and things aren't sustainable and they're overlord is like, give me more, they'll just leave and they'll go to the desert. They'll go to a place where they can hunt. They'll go to some place where no one's going to be watching them. They'll walk to the oases. They'll go somewhere. And that's one method. You don't see real uprisings until you have an industrial middle class. And that's arguably not until maybe the late period at the very beginnings in some of Egypt's population centers like Memphis or Heliopolis or the northern delta cities. But, you know, really when you get to Greco-Roman Egypt and you have Alexandria, there's revolts there all the time. And the people of Alexandria in their industrialized world would go on bread riots. They would make their voices heard to the ruling elites and the king and queen in Alexandria because they could, because not doing their craftsmanship or whatever middle-class labor they were doing would hurt their overlords. And there you see a different kind of resistance. Or you could argue at that same time period, you have Upper Egyptian elites who refuse to give grain as the due of the king to the north. So there's, but you know, if it's an elite refusing to do it, is that a revolt? Not really. It's just an elite resistance. So you don't get those revolts until really a middle class and a capitalist middle class starts to gain power in the world.
Oh, there's just, it's so complicated and so fascinating. And you do such a beautiful job of encapsulating and storytelling with this much needed and sadly missing perspective from, as you mentioned, from the very beginning of your training up until now. And that's not to say that there aren't other Egyptologists or historians, art historians with a feminist perspective. Of course there are, but it's been the exception, not the norm. And it's just so refreshing to have these conversations with you and to continue to learn from you. So I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I just want to thank you for taking that time with us today. And we only scratched the surface. There's so much more in the book. So thank you for being here. And I'm hoping before you go that you'll be willing to answer the two closing questions that I ask all of my guests that I bring on the show.
Yeah, go for it. And it's been my pleasure to talk. These have been great questions, great discussion.
So listen, I always ask my guests to think about the future. You know, it's funny, you spend a lot of time thinking about the past, but of course you also contextualize that within the present and the future. So when you think about the future, and this can be in whatever context is relevant to you, it can have to do with your work, your personal life, you know, it can be local, it can be global, it could be cosmic. I want to know two things. The first is, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night? The thing that you're most concerned about, where you're finding maybe some pessimism, even potentially some cynicism? You know, what are you truly deeply concerned about? And then on the flip side of that, so we end on a slightly more positive note, where are you finding your hope, your optimism? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, I love these questions. And I wrote the last chapter of my book, The Good Kings, very much within this vein of thinking. As for what keeps me up at night, I would say that we need a lot more critical pushback against these celebrations of the year of the woman, and the woman, you know, is equal to the man, and we've made it. We're not even close, in my opinion, and we celebrate way too early. In the same way that so many books have been written about Egyptian female rulers, but as a positivist cipher of, look, the Egyptians could do it and we're doing it now too, and we all pat ourselves on the back, instead of looking at these Egyptian female rulers as tools of the patriarchy. I think what keeps me up at night is a lot of criticism of people saying I'm a killjoy, or I'm not representing female power as the glorious thing that it was, and I have to take it down. That's not my intent. My intent is to say, if there was female power within this patriarchal structure, and that's still our system, then how are we going to really create a feminist reality in which half of the population has half of the power too? And not just say, oh, we've made it, we're done. And, you know, like the Johnny Depp Heard case today, however despicable they may have acted against each other, these kinds of things don't necessarily help. That's patriarchy in action. And we love to demonize women. And my own power in my own university has been demonized by colleagues. And that and it's amazing how misogyny is alive and well within even left-wing intellectual worlds that are supposedly taken over by feminist thinking. Not true. So there is a lot of work to be done. And then the hopeful note is that people are doing it. It's happening. People are deciding to choose a non-binary path. People who are deciding to be male or female are opting out of patriarchal strictures of marriage, childbearing. They're having children if they want. They're not having them if they don't. They're living together in sin before marriage. People are abandoning religions that control us. And we're all seeing things. We can all feel it. And yes, there are the people of color. You know, Black people are like, really? We've been seeing this for a long time. Get with it. And they're right. You know, this is absolutely true. That finally, white females are like, oh, yeah, I get it now. That's an absolutely fair criticism. But I think as an American society, but also as a global society, people are seeing the patriarchy for what it is. They are seeing the man behind the curtain. They are seeing how he pulls the strings. Make no mistake, as that patriarch is being recognized, the weapons used to disillusion people about the reality of what they're seeing, to gaslight people into saying that's not really what you're seeing, those weapons are coming out more powerfully than ever before. So we are now, in two tracks, in my opinion. There is the one track of people who are saying, if we all agree that we're on the edge of a precipice of something big happening, I think left and right, people will agree on that. Everyone is afraid of what is to come. We know there is something to come. On the right, you will have people saying we need to go back to what it was, to the good old glory days and make everything great again. And then on the left, you have people saying, okay, we need to create sustainability. We need to move into a different reality. How do we do it? How do we get rid of the plastic that we use every day? How do we create equity for people? And these two tracks are running side by side. And then, as I say in my last chapter of The Good Kings, there is a bit of a curveball thrown at us, because I would say these arguments have been had before, but the curveball is the earth. And the earth is like, it's not going to, you can't rebuild this again if it falls apart. When this one falls apart, it's going to be your last shot. So here it is. I'm giving you warming oceans, warming climate. I'm giving you what the fossil fuel hoarding has done. I'm giving you the results of you cutting down all your forests. I'm giving it to you. Here it is. Look at it. Figure it out. And there comes a point when you have to decide as a human species writ large that you will move together into a place where you can continue to exist rather than not. And it's so interesting to see that happening in society all around you. It's beautiful, frightening, and chilling all at the same time, and quite messy.
I couldn't agree more. Oh, everybody, the book is The Good Kings, Absolute Power in Ancient Egypt and the Modern World. And of course, check out Kara's two previous books and keep your eyes open for the new one dropping later this year or early next. Kara, thank you so, so much for spending time with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
So did I. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.